thing with every reasonable approach to human beings. If one wants to call somebody who is himself still in plain reason to reason, if he made only even a mistake based on wrong conclusions, he does not like this kind of approach at all. And philosophers have always been, if they were worth their thoughts, the most hated human beings in humanity. And rightly so, because they always wanted to wake people up to their mistakes. Now the masses, and then with reasons which are overcome to us by the time of the Enlightenment, reasons that convince not even us anymore, let alone people who have never heard of it, because the reasons in themselves have become faulty. Much more fulminant reasons would have to be brought forth in order to change such a state of affairs. They aren't there yet, they are just coming up, and it is very doubtful if they will be of great help as far as the masses are concerned. We have to try that somewhere else, namely as long as we have free states, by plain laws, barring certain kinds of modern ideologies. This will be a hard thing to do, especially in a democracy where everybody believes everybody should be free. Yeah, but nobody should be free to throw the stones of slander, of plain slander, on whole parts of a population because of racial prejudices, to say the Jews are the pest of the world or the Negroes are the pest of the world or whatever. Slander is the pre-step, the first step to murder. It has always been the first step to murder. So the laws for slandering as well persons as whole population parts, if they would be sharpened, that would first be an approach at least to make it not so easy for everybody to brew up such a kind of a brew. Enlightenment teaching also has to be done. But to rely only on that is a little crazy in our time. It's a little late in the day for it. But in the end, only this will help. Namely, not enlightenment, but real use of philosophy and of thinking by demasking the methods by which those things are done, by understanding them fully, and now really being able to explain how it works and not just say, oh, this is plain nonsense, racism, science has proved that doesn't exist, which nobody believes. Direct attack means to go, to recognize first, and then attack directly the method by which all those things are done. And the reasons, not reasons, those are not reasons, the causes by which those phenomena come up again and again in our time. There it might be helpful to us to watch another little thing that seems so harmless, harmless up to now, and that is even hidden, because it is hidden mostly in education and in our very universities, which are supposed to be, so to speak, the bulwarks, the castells of defending reason and even furthering reason. An imperceptible thing, first. It moves in two ways. We said, saw that idealistic and materialistic metaphysical systems, pseudo-metaphysical and pseudo-scientific, are the means by which those ideologies come about. I should have mentioned at that time that an extreme form of this dry logic which tries to pervade all our thinking is in modern philosophy and scientific philosophy the field of so-called semantics and logical positivism, and then in the larger sense, the field of positivistic science itself. Positivism is a metaphysics and not a science. It starts from a very cheap metaphysical assumption, from the assumption that nothing that cannot be verified by the senses can possibly be existent. This is materialism in its most superstitious form. But it claims to be scientific, and it has caused many philosophers, the majority of the philosophers of our time, to throw away their own obligations and their own business in order to become the servant of the sciences, or to think they can become the servants of the scientists, of the sciences. They are even proud of it, not to be occupied with so-called metaphysical questions at all anymore. They throw them aside, like Hans Reichenbach saying, if we only wouldn't have all those crazy people who come back and back and ask unanswerable questions. Unanswerable questions. That means metaphysical questions, questions that concern man's very life, certainty, security, and creative possibilities. Those are the unanswerable questions, the metaphysical questions. Let's throw them aside, they say. Forget about it. Let's only ask answerable questions. Oh yeah, and then the answerable questions turn up. How can philosophy help best to convince, let's say, a certain population that it should be eliminated? There's an old English joke. The farmer assembled the chicken around him and proposes to discuss with them the question how they should be boiled or boiled and what method they should be. And the chicken insists that we don't want to be cooked. And the man says, strictly scientific in this modern scientific, pseudo-scientific sense, you dodge the question. Well, philosophers are supposed to be the people who permanently dodge the question, namely ask, when you engage in such a so-called scientific application of your scientific principles to certain layers of human beings, I ask first the question, should that be done at all? What is really the end? And I question your end. That, of course, should not be done because it interrupts the free developing logical process of scientific inquiry and conclusion, which, of course, has the right to ask of all of us that we become voluntary guinea pigs for any kind of experiment that might be interesting and deliver scientific results. But we are like those chicken, we permanently want to insist, but we don't want to be guinea pigs. So this positivistic superstition, which has been especially widespread on American universities, has caused one layer of philosophers who were anyhow bad paid and the last ones to be employed on it. Who cares about philosophy? To get discouraged and really to become this full of goodwill, the helpers of those systems. Then, when the awareness came that there might be something wrong with those things, and we get in the masses those reactions like the pseudo-religious revivals we see all around. And they start to cry, oh, science seems to be so bad if applied to human affairs. Let's go back to religion. One must believe something. Let's, the next God, let's present him. Let's believe, let's pray again. It might help. again, a plain magical performance. Prayer, in the sense of Christianity and Judaism, has never been anymore since Miss Brooke a magic performance. It was talking or trying to talk in understanding to the highest supposed absolute personal being that is the creator of the world. There was not the slightest idea in it that it could be possible by uttering prayers to influence him, to have a kind of magical procedure with him that he must grant, that he will absolutely help, nothing like that. But in modern prayer, and especially and in modern religions, even if modern people think they are religious, this practice has become very widespread. The practice of magical prayer. What I want, an even more imperceptible thing. Another part of philosophers, whom we can call broadly existentialist philosophers. Those are, and here only a part of them, namely the non-atheistic existentialist philosophers. The atheistic, like Sartre and the French existentialists, which are very much en vogue in their method is a different one. And it amounts very much to the method of the positivistic philosophers, namely the last formulation they have is always, we are not committed enough, we have to commit ourselves. There is nothing commits us anymore. Nobody is really alive because he cannot commit himself anymore. Now, this is again one of those slippery propositions where the lie is served by the truth. Positions we meet everywhere in our life. So I have to engage again to make that clear in the hated metaphysicians' business to split one hair in seven, what they all say, which the metaphysician unfortunately is never able to do. If he gets a hair, he gets a bunch of sticky hairs, and if he can 100 sticky hairs bunched together, split in three parts, he's already lucky. Let alone that he could split a hair in seven parts. But this hair splitting business we have to do here in order to see what is involved in this so convincing saying of the atheistic part of the existentialists, namely, we are in our time not committed enough. Nothing that is proposed to us we take as a real value, and man cannot find himself if he cannot use his freedom for committing himself. This is unfortunately true. It is so that indeed in our time the phenomenon that most people are not committed, and that they shun commitment to such a degree as permanently saying, I won't stick my neck out. This is an overall phenomenon. That much is true. The question is only how came it about and how can it be helped? To say, now you are in that state, now please become aware of it. What is your main thing is to commit yourself to something. Then we have as the effect immediately this faith religion, this believing also in every ideology that is presented. They want to commit themselves. That is how Monsieur Sartre himself came finally by this his philosophy to commit himself permanently to the French Communist Party, member or no member. He is no member, but he goes along as long as he possibly can, in goodwill, because otherwise he feels He's isolated from the masses. That would be terrible. He's isolated from the masses. He must have contact. He must belong. And so he goes any lengths because he has that philosophy, modern man must be committed. He must be able to commit himself in order to show that he is really free. Yes, this is the criteria of freedom. But if commitment itself becomes the question, and it is, so people are told, you have to commit yourself in order to help yourself in this one, then one rules, one gives again a witch's brew. One rules out the answer, the Socratic answer of common sense and wisdom. On the lowest levels, common sense. On the highest levels, critical wisdom. Because that is what the tree of philosophy really is. It cannot afford to throw away common sense, as science can, for experiment's sake. So what is ruled out and prevented is the question, Socratic question of the man who is told you must commit yourself. That he could say ironically as Socrates, oh, how much I would want to be able to commit myself, my friend. Are you able to show me something worthwhile to commit myself to? Because otherwise I will be called by you a nihilist, a negative nihilist, a non-active, who withers away and cannot commit himself. I am ready to endure that as long as I cannot see something to which I really want to commit myself, because I see value in it. I will not take any kind of substitute that is offered to me on the street corner in order to save myself, so to speak. Have the fake feeling of myself that now I have been able to commit myself. So many have committed themselves to changing metaphysical, pseudo-metaphysical propositions of our time. And we have already a few very significant and wonderful intellectuals before us of our time who have been almost in any camp already and have been through all of them. And they have been worn down by and emptied. So, not to face the necessary nihilistic situation, as Nietzsche always said, which means to accept the condition under which we have been put, namely that it is for us especially hard to commit ourselves, that we want to be fully convinced, and that we must find reasons for committing ourselves to something definitely in our own experience in order to be definitely convinced. Until then, to have the courage to stay in that situation and to see it through, that is the positive side of Friedrich Nietzsche, who recommended just that. Do not fall for sheep substitutes. Be aware in what situation you are and fortify yourself to endure that situation till you really can overcome it, till you really can go beyond. But do not go on a sideline and think then you have solved the problem. You will only ruin yourself and help to ruin the human world. But the other branch of the existentialists, this branch that is religious, the religious existentialists, like Jasper, Sverdyaev, Tillich, to mention only a few, Buber, they have seen that with the breakdown of reason, that reason which had become in the meantime mere logos, logicality, and rationality, ratio, scientific. They have witnessed how by this situation every kind of religious feeling and activity, genuine religious feeling and activity, of modern men has vanished. Now, they want to restore that, to help restore that, to bring back a certain fullness of life which has vanished. And they try it by either dissolving theological problems, using theological problems, religious problems, for leading people back into real philosophy, or using modern philosophical results or part results, partial results, in order to jump now over the distinction between religious thinking and living and philosophic thinking and living, and declare this is one. Philosophy can only be helped and religion can only be helped if they become one again. They use, unwillingly or full of goodwill, and with the best intentions in the world, with the most sublime intentions in the world, for this very purpose, they use, also the neo-Thomists, Jacques Maritain, who was not an existentialist philosopher, belongs to that line, they want to have the medieval state of affairs where they think philosophy and philosophic thinking and religious thinking have been one, not seeing that if they are supposed to be one, that then philosophy necessarily is the servant of religion. There is no other way. So that what really comes out of it is to lure people back to religion by philosophic means. That means by illegitimate means. Faith cannot be regained, and faith doth not come by philosophic means. One cannot win God back, or a belief in a definite God, by reasoning and by using philosophic propositions. If one does, the philosophic propositions will be falsified. They will be degraded. And if they are degraded, then the result will indeed be a very sorry one. And in this method now, namely, let's say, mixing up with the positivists, philosophy and science, mixing them up. In the other method, mixing up philosophy and religion, there we can distinguish that one of the ingredients, the necessary ingredients, of all modern witches' brews is the mixing up of two different disciplines of the human mind. Mixing up history with politics, that is how Karl Marx started, and the result we have. Mixing up history with natural science, and the results are bitter results. And here now, mixing up science per se and positivism with philosophy, and on the other hand, in this kind brand of existentialism, mixing up religion with philosophy. This mixing up has a strange flavor. It is the way by which the remainders of mythical elements long forgotten flow back into the logical mind and overflood it. this mixing those disciplines up seems to open a door for the influx of uncontrollable, merely pictorial and superstitional mythical elements. Why? If we want, like some modern religious existentialists, if we mix up philosophy and religion, then we get a kind of vague religiosity, a religiosity that is undefinable, becomes more and more undefinable. If you look at those philosophers, though they are all very different, they come from the Protestant, from the Catholic, and from the Jewish camp, and they cannot even distinguish between themselves anymore, because they are all swimming in the same kind of vague religiosity, so that for a Jewish boy on a college, it's entirely indifferent if he wants to hear about existentialism, that kind of existentialism, if he is presented with Mr. Tillich or Mr. Buber. That is really, I mean, one and the same thing, and is entirely indifferent. That means every distinction between the religions and great religions has vanished. Has it vanished into a synthesis of a higher kind? Oh no, it has vanished by the use of a kind of mechanical symbolism that is used here. Now, symbolism as a method is a thing that should be, that we have already mentioned, that should make us think again about that. We have found that mythical people whom we consider such symbolistic people have indeed been never symbolistic. They didn't even know what a symbol is. For them, what we consider today symbols, their propositions of Indra or Wotan, were propositions of reality and not of symbols. They didn't symbolize anything. Brahma doesn't symbolize anything. Brahma is. But for us, if we study myths, and we do it now for over 100 years, we can gain a philosophic meaning of myths and something valuable out of myths, of course, only if we use the symbolistic method. We approach that as symbols. For us, they are symbols. We don't believe in them. If now this symbolistic performance, the symbolistic method, is used by philosophers in order, as a fake and vaguely, to unite all possible religions and religious experiences in the world by telling this, all those are all symbols for something else. If you hear some, and I had the occasion to be forced to discuss with a Protestant minister, who is also an existentialist religious philosopher, to discuss religious questions. And it came up to the point where he very paternally patted my shoulder and said, "My friend, I mean, you do not understand that for us, Christ is a symbol." And I said to him, "Oh, please, don't drive me into the insane asylum. Handling Christ as a symbol, I am doing that, because I am a philosopher. You are a religious man. Of you, I thought you believe Christ is the Son of God. Do you believe that or don't you? What is this discussion about? Why do you butt into my business with this anyhow, a sorry one? Namely, to be obliged to look at all those figures and things as symbols in order to clarify the human mind about them, which is my sour business. Now you come and steal my bread with incompetent means, not having been trained for it, and you throw out of the window that what we have to expect of you if you come to me and say you are a Protestant minister. I want to see a man who believes in God.